So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Tuesday is the anniversary of the first Tarzan movie to hit the silver screen.
Then on Wednesday, we tell the story of how Gottlieb Daimler inadvertently invented the motorbike.
On Thursday, we explain how MSG got demonized in the 1960s.
And on Friday, we revisit a legendary battle on a frozen Russian lake.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes each weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit YahooFinance.com, the number one financial destination, YahooFinance.com.
Hello and welcome to the Media Podcast. I'm Ollie Mann. On today's show, as former controller Michael Grade weighs into the debate, how long has Channel 4 got before it's privatised and how could it thrive? ITV boss Adam Crozier thinks he can run the BBC better than the current lot by merging Radio 4 and 5 Live. Adam Crozier, more like. Plus, Yentob goes, TV ad revenue goes through the roof, and in the media quiz, we tackle the industry's corrections and clarifications. That's all to come on today's Media Podcast. And joining me this Friday at the Hospital Club is the Managing Director of TV Indie Lemonade Money and at least my fifth favourite Faraz. It's Faraz Osman. Hello.
Yay. Hello, how are you?
Very well, thank you. Faraz, not only are you back, but it's back.
Okay, what is it?
It's on the internet and you put
it
in your ears. There
yes,
we
it is
go.
Real back.
I was wondering how many clues.
I literally texted my wife this morning kind of going, OMG. She sent me an amazing GIF emoji off the back of it. I haven't listened to it yet. In fact, I'm a little bit tense. I kind of want to finish this so I can go and find out what's going on.
Do you think it's going
have you
to
heard
be,
it yet?
I haven't heard it yet. Do you think it's going to be as big news as the first series?
No, of course not. What is really interesting is the fact that there's not been more serialised podcasts. So I thought that there'll be kind of a real glut of them. But the only other one that I'm listening to is My Dad Wrote a Porno, which is hilarious, and you know, without wanting to over intellectualise it, is a serialised podcast. Mm. And so you kind of look forward to knowing the next bit of the story each week.
I think there's probably been a glut of them commissioned and people just haven't downloaded them at quite the same speed. But yes, if we somehow have just alerted you to the fact that the second series of Serial is now live and you feel that tension that you have to press pause on the media pod right now and chug back 15 hours of Was He a Killer or Not? Feel free, and then come back afterwards, because I know what it's like. Relieve yourself first. Also joining us in the Hospital Club is broadcast consultant par excellence, Paul Robinson.
Hi, Ollie.
Hello. I understand you took an A380 today, the double-decker.
I did, yes, from Singapore. I was at ATF, which is the Asian television market. Fascinating. Growing. More and more formats coming out of Japan and China. You know, the whole Asian business is just absolutely booming.
Really? Because you don't hear a lot about that, do you?
You do not. And, of course, for a British company, it's a great place to go and sell. So, you know, we're selling stuff to the Asian broadcasters. And, of course, there aren't very many of us there. I mean, there are a few friends I bumped into, but not many. If you haven't been before, I suggest next December you get on a plane to Singapore and spend some very nice time at Marina Bay Sands. You'll probably make a bit of money. And you'll have a great time.
I guess maybe for British broadcasters, it just feels less complicated to take a Dutch format or an Israeli format or a Canadian format than it does to say, let's take the latest thing that's big in Hong Kong.
Well, it depends whether it works for your audience and whether you want something that's different and hasn't been seen before. I mean, you know, the point is that doing business there is really easy. I mean, Singapore, everybody speaks amazing English, so it's not a problem.
And was there good entertainment on the plane?
I watched about 2.5 movies and fell asleep.
What airline were you on?
I was on BA.
Well, you could have listened to Answer Me This on BA.
Pardon? I could have done.
Pardon? What? It's there. It's on the Comedy Podcast channel.
I could have done, but didn't. I'm just being honest.
No. Well, fine. So long as you were aware of the option, I'm sure they announced it on the Tannoy. Right, let's talk about some proper media news. They've only recently made some shiny new idents, but now Channel 4 might be changing entirely from a state-owned, commercially funded operation to an entirely privatised broadcaster with shareholders and an expectation of profit. This week, former controller Lord Grade weighed in, saying it would be a good thing for the channel and that it could become a media powerhouse, despite the fact that, of course, when he ran Channel 4, he used to campaign against this very thing. Meanwhile, David Abram gave an interview to Broadcast in which he sounded torn between his role as chief executive of Channel 4 and being a champion for the channel as a publicly owned body. It kind of all makes my head hurt, this, Faraz, Channel 4 privatisation. It's the kind of thing people throw around as a term, and I struggle to actually understand what the options are. If you wanted it to stay distinctive, then it's never going to make loads of money for a commercial entity, and if they took it, then they'd end up dumbing it down, wouldn't they, inevitably? I think that part of the problem is people think, when you have this debate, people think that Channel 4 are getting licence fee money, which they're obviously not. It's a quite complicated model to kind of explain off the cuff, I think, that when you have a commercially funded, publicly owned broadcaster. The distinctiveness question has changed significantly from when Channel 4 first started. You had four channels and kind of being distinctive was an important thing. Now, actually, being distinctive, when you look at things like Vice and Dazed and Confused and other broadcasters and brands around the world, being distinctive has helped get you market share. So there is a kind of private commercial incentive to being distinctive now, which is why Channel 4 continues to be successful. But I think that there's a, this idea is in itself lunacy. I don't think anybody's calling for Channel 4 to be privatised apart from the government, who want a bit of a cash windfall. But I think that what we do need to talk about now is what the public service value of Channel 4 is. And this kind of distinctiveness thing is banded around a lot. And obviously Channel 4 do a great job of all their documentaries, but we now have no children's programming on Channel 4 whatsoever. Any programming for people under the age of 25 is a bit of a question mark, and their reach continues to decline in that space other than their acquisitions in the American space. And I think it would be useful for Channel 4 to be put under a bit more pressure to figure out why this is state funded and what value it is giving to its viewers beyond just beyond just the standard interesting documentaries and gritty dramas.
But doesn't the point remain, Paul, that no private organisation running Channel 4 would keep Channel 4 News like it is, for example, an hour a night, which basically has no one watching but is very valuable? No private company is going to have that many documentaries on after episodes of a reality format.
I think you have to decide what you want, and we should remember that Channel 4 was dreamed up over 30 years ago in a market when there were currently three channels, and it was the fourth channel. There was no Sky, there was no cable, there was nothing else. And it was designed to do two things. It's designed to increase choice, but particularly to stimulate the independent sector and also to be this publisher broadcaster, so other people had access to the airways. And the government of the day did not want to allocate licence fee, as Sarah says, so the decision was made to make it advertising funded. Now, despite what you say, an advertising funded public broadcaster is completely a common model. We have ITV in the UK, and most of the public broadcasters around the world are funded via advertising. We'll talk about ABC in Australia later, and that again is an ad funded model plus government funding. So it's a very usual model to have a public broadcaster, public service broadcaster, funded via advertising. Nothing funny about that. What is funny about it is that Channel 4 has changed from what it was, and maybe now isn't quite sure what it is or what it should be. As you were saying, most of its top-rated programmes are actually acquisitions, US acquisitions. And in prime time, most of the content is US content. It does do some great stuff, dispatches and so on, amazing, great news, yes. But there's no reason to say that those things couldn't necessarily survive in the public broadcaster, because it would actually be in their commercial interest to do so. In terms of the government making a windfall, I'm not sure that's the issue. The issue is it's probably a little bit anachronistic now for Channel 4 to continue doing what it does, spending a huge amount acquiring US content and be government-owned. That doesn't make any sense at all. It's also in a situation where, because it's advertising-funded and because it therefore depends on ratings, its share is declining. Even if you add together all of the additional channels it's launched over previous past years, its total share is declining and will continue to decline. So Channel 4 in the existing model will just face a slow and lingering death. So I think the question is, what do you want Channel 4 to be, and should you rethink the model? And I think rethinking the model is entirely the right thing. But where you start is, what do you want Channel 4 to do?
I think the thing for me is, as running an independent production company, is that, you know, I think we're really blessed in the UK to have that plurality of different models that allow you to think differently into how you come up with ideas and hopefully get ideas commissioned along the way. And I think it's really important to continue to encourage that. And what I worry about is that once you have a similar model as Channel 5 and ITV does, and that almost diminishes choice. So I think Sky is a subscription model, and that is a good thing because that has its own value. They have, you know, they do lots of very big ticket items. The BBC is obviously a complete license fee model, public service broadcast, and I think that should continue. And I think having Channel 4 as this kind of third way is actually a really decent thing. And I would say as well is that Channel 4 have done a really interesting job of, you know, I get very angry, and the people that we work with get very angry when Channel 4 make a bad commissioning decision, much more so than when Channel 5 do it, or when Sky do it, or even when the BBC does it, because it feels like it belongs to the audience in a way that that is important to independent producers and also the people that end up watching the programmes as well. And I would feel that if you turn it into a completely public company, sorry, a completely private company, you start to chip away at that that level of ownership that people have about it. And I don't think that that's just a sentimental thing. I genuinely think that helps creativity, and it helps people to push the boundaries. And, you know, things like TFI Friday coming back has frustrated a lot of people, because you want to see more of that anarchic sensibilities from a new generation and a new set of brands. And what I worry about is that decisions like TFI and as you say, American Acquisitions, they become the norm for a channel like Channel 4, because they're gunning to make profit and want to make sure they have those big branded hits out of the gate, above and beyond creating new content.
I sort of agree with all of that, actually. I mean, the only thing I disagree with is about the funding model, because I think you're absolutely right that, you know, whilst it's nice that Evans is back doing TFI Friday, so much better to have a new version of that with a new young team. And also I think it's critical that companies like yours and others are encouraged and feel they have a place to do things which are experimental, different, unique, you know, distinctive. Absolutely. And if Channel 4 couldn't do that, that would be a loss to British production. But I don't think that means it can't be private. I don't think it's about whether it's private or public. It's about what it's meant to be doing, what you want it to do. Because you can fund it. You could certainly fund it commercially, and you could build into that brief in the way ITV has built into its brief. It has to do certain things at certain times.
Okay, final point about something David Abrams said, actually, in this interview, is he said something, it was a bit codified, but he said something like, I think it's time that producers started having a view on this situation, or something like that. It was quite clear that he was kind of saying he'd welcome indies to get together and make a big fuss about this, like they have about the BBC and the government doing their charter review into that. Faraz, do you think, in a sense, there is a burden on all of these indies to say, a lot of us justify our existence on the fact that Channel 4 continues to use us, that there's the government should be aware that if they make Channel 4 private, then companies like ours might not be able to exist?
Well, I don't know if that's necessarily true. I, you know, we have done some work for Channel 4, but they aren't the reason we're still alive today.
But some companies do exist on a couple of commissions, don't they?
Yeah, they do exist on a couple of commissions.
And there's hundreds of indies now, basically because of Channel 4's role.
Well, I mean, the indie sector exists because of Channel 4. I think it would be very difficult for anybody to argue that. You know, the indie community exploded once Channel 4 came on the scene, before it was just controlled by the BBC and ITV. And it's one of the reasons why we have some of the greatest formats coming out of the UK, as those companies have continued to grow. They've done a really interesting job post Big Brother of steadying the ship. This privatisation thing, I think, has caught them very much by surprise. But the reason it's come up is because all of the public service stuff that Channel 4 was known for, and that kind of anarchic, irreverent nature that Channel 4 used to be about, I feel has slightly gone away. And that's why this conversation is being had. And let's be completely honest. You know, and I'm sure that David and Jay and all of the guys at Channel 4 would argue the other way, but it does feel to me like when it comes to the primetime stuff, when it comes to the stuff that actually generates revenue and continues to build brands, things like Gogglebox, things like The Jump, they're all coming from big, big indies. Whereas the smaller indies are almost kind of given these short form places, or, you know, they've created Channel 4 Shorts and that they're looking to commission a lot of people in that space, but they're very small budgets. They're very, you know, they're not companies, you know, they're not budgets that you can help grow a company out of. There's a feeling that, from, I feel from the indie community, is that, well, you know, give us a punt at, you know, we mentioned TFI Friday. That's what I think, I feel it's a really good example. There's no reason why, I mean, I would say this, but running a young independent production company, but there's no reason why that brief can't be opened up to people who haven't done that space before in a classic Channel 4 way, where it almost used to be management consultants kind of going, we need to fill this slot, tell us what we should do. It's flipped now, where it's commissioners going, we want you to make this. And, you know, they'll go to the bigger indies where the relationships exist, and they have an unlimited resource of development team, which almost kind of shuts out smaller indies as a result. So there's a lot of work that has to kind of been done to retrofit all of that as well. You know, yes, they've steadied the ship. Yes, the ratings have kind of stabilised. Yes, they're winning awards. But are they actually encouraging the indie market in a way that they should be? I think that is quite questionable.
Okay, so it might actually be a bit of a tough ask to get all of these indies to get too upset about this going on at Channel 4. Whilst we were talking about Jay Hunt, actually, briefly, and she's the current controller of Channel 4, she's now been linked to a job in Australia. What's that about?
Again, so she's been linked to this job a couple of times now, I think. But
this is at ABC.
This is at ABC, yeah. So, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if she did move on. I think kind of going back to my earlier point of the fact that the ship has been steadied, and there were lots of question marks when she came in, and there was lots of criticism, and that seems to have kind of gone away now. They have some hits. The ratings are stabilised, and this is the next big question that has to be answered. It doesn't surprise me that there may be a way of solving that is to kind of have a bit of a reshuffle to see if there's somebody else out there that wants to tackle that problem, similar to how, you know, Danny Cohen is moving on before licensing renegotiation that's coming up as well. So I think that it wouldn't surprise me if she did decide that this was the right time for her to go. I guess she'll be bowing out on a high.
And a comparable gig, Paul, ABC?
It's a bigger gig for her. I mean, bigger budget, ABC Australia, bigger budget than Channel 4. ABC have got four channels, and plus their news channel.
Channel 4 will tell you they've got four channels as well, of course.
Yeah, but okay.
But playing music videos
ABC
doesn't count,
got
I agree.
Four proper channels. Big investment in kids. You know, kids and news have been their big investments. They want to be the BBC. They have ambitions like the BBC. You know, they are an example of a government-funded broadcaster topped up by advertising. And their big challenge is, unlike the BBC, which has a licence fee, they are squeezed by the government if they don't do what the government likes. That is a challenge for the ABC. And they have ambitions like the BBC, but of course Australia is a much smaller country, 40% the size of the UK. So they've never got enough money. So they're always struggling to do things. So someone like Jay, who's worked at Channel 4, who's got, you know, the creative background, understands budgets, understands the UK market, I think would be very attractive to the ABC, and she could probably do a very good job there.
I've actually just come back from Australia after doing a little bit of work out there, and this is purely anecdotally, and I don't have any evidence or statistics to back this up, but I was almost shocked by the lack of diversity compared to the actual people that, I mean, I was in Sydney, and Sydney seems to be a very diverse place. There's lots of people from Asia and East Asia that have moved over there and settled over there, and their television really doesn't feel like it's reflective of the population that's out there at the moment. And I think Jay coming from Channel 4 with that remit to celebrate diversity, it would be nice to see if that has a positive impact on that network as a result.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, right, let's talk about ads, because Christmas is around the corner. I don't know if you noticed. And this Christmas we'll see a record amount spent on television advertising, according to research by Zenith Optimedia. Paul, £310 million being spent just this month in December. How good is that? Put that in perspective for us.
Well, it's a significant increase on year, and I think the question you have to ask is why. What's interesting, of course, is that retail patterns have fundamentally changed, Black Friday being the single biggest change. And of course what's happened in the past is that what was normally the biggest retail week of the year was the week immediately prior to Christmas. So in terms of this podcast, next week would be the biggest week. It has no longer been the biggest week in the last few years, and Black Friday has changed all that. And you have, you know, a number of retailers saying, actually, well, we would rather not be in Black Friday, but we have to because everybody else is. So I think this is about actually trying to really stimulate full price sales just prior to Christmas, and advertising is being used to do that. And of course TV advertising is the most powerful way of advertising. It'll be interesting to see if it works. If it does, I think it could be a sustained growth. If it doesn't, it could be a blip.
People are going to be surprised to hear you say that TV advertising is the most powerful form of advertising. Digital ads are on the rise, aren't they?
Digital is more focused and more targeted, but it's also more expensive in terms of reaching mass people. And I know you're a radio guy, but TV is the most powerful advertising medium. There's no question about that. That's beyond dispute.
But we're going to see digital overtake TV eventually, aren't 2017, they reckon.
Well, digital advertising is, I would argue, and again, this is anecdotally, but I would argue digital advertising is far more irritating than television advertising. And I have always wondered about what that does for people's brands. And, you know, when you get these pop-up ads, when you get these pre-rolls in particular around video, they are incredibly frustrating to people trying to engage with content. You know, when you have some online services and you have to watch 3 30-second adverts before you can actually get to your content, that is something that's a poor negative experience. Whereas with television, there is an adopted language that has been learned over a number of generations, which allows people to watch a bit of their content, take a break, see some adverts, and it's I feel it's more accepted, and the celebration of good advertising on television, the John Lewis advert that everyone always talks about every year, is part of that. I think very few people talk about an amazing online advert that's a pre-roll to a YouTube video. What's particularly interesting is what YouTube have done around YouTube Red. And in addition to that, the fact that Facebook and YouTube have started to, and Google and all of these digital brands are advertising on television. I mean, for me, that says something really significant about what these brands that have made an obscene amount of money from an advertising model feel about television when it comes to breaking through with their own brand awareness. And I think YouTube Red is incredibly interesting because it's saying...
Explain what YouTube Red is for those who aren't aware.
YouTube Red is a new... subscription service where you can pay a monthly subscription to YouTube to not watch any advertising, and it's come off the back of the popularity of ad blockers, where people are installing plugins to avoid advertising, some broadcasters in this country have then blocked users who use ad blockers from watching any of their content as a result. So there's this weird online war between consumers trying to avoid advertising online and broadcasters who are saying that we need this to survive. But you would, we have Sky Plus and we have kind of PVRs that allow you to skip adverts and fast forward through them, but you're still seeing the brands, you're still kind of fast forwarding them at 30 plus speed, but people kind of accept it, and I think that's allowed brands to continue to use television to thrive. And I think that this is where television becomes really powerful, and it's why Netflix and iPlayer have been so successful, because they don't have any advertising whatsoever. It means that you can get to your content straight away. There's a real value in the fact that if you want to advertise, TV is still the best place for you to do that.
Except I just did wonder, Paul, whether some of the secret behind these rising figures in TV ads is actually to do with digital, because people make video campaigns that they're going to put up on YouTube, and there's a symbiosis between the two if it's a well-constructed campaign.
Well, as you were saying, they've also got all these new brand categories, all the digital brands advertising on television, so they're effectively new to TV, bringing in more money. But, I agree with what you say, and that is that if you want to build a brand, you can't do that online. Building a brand is about an emotional connection. It's about a combination of, great creative music, images, emotion. It's an emotional thing, and you can do that really well on television. Much less easy to do that on online, not least because you're in a different mood. It's a different mindset. And the other point, I think, about online video is you shouldn't forget that online video is not just YouTube. There's three models for paying for online video. It's a subscription, it's transactional, or it's advertising. And advertising is only about a third of the total revenue accrued to online video. So people are choosing to either download to own, or they're choosing to rent via Netflix or Amazon Prime or whatever, or they can have YouTube. And there's three different models. It's also interesting, not just YouTube Red, but the YouTube Kids app launched in the UK 3 weeks ago. And there's already been negative reaction to advertising on pre-rolls on kids' programs from parents saying, I don't want my two-year-old watching an ad for an insurance company before they see Peppa Pig, because that's what's happening.
Yeah, and actually in that particular example, briefly for us, but it is fascinating, with the kids' app, this idea of brand integration, which people say is less irritating than the pre-roll video, that's very problematic when you're targeting children, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, brand integration is a model that I think will continue to grow, and I think it's a useful model as well. I think that people...
But if it's useful for indoctrinating children, then parents are going to be concerned.
Yeah, I think kids' television in particular is always trickier. I think that kids' TV is a very different, significantly different model to the rest of television. I think that the ability to make back-end revenue out of it and sell it worldwide, particularly with things like animation and things like Peppa Pig, if you get kids' TV right... you can become very rich of secondary rights off the back of it, which is why where the value is there. Selling insurance adverts against Peppa Pig is a little bit silly. I think that what we will start seeing is brand endorsement or product endorsement within Peppa Pig for things that you can then end up going to Toys R Us and buying that are related to that programming. It feels like that's a bit dirty, but when you actually look at what things like Star Wars are doing, you know, they are creating product, they're creating films, and the first thing that you saw out of that new Star Wars trailer was a toy that you could be buying for the last 2 months. Nobody knows what the character is with BB-8, but you can go and buy one, and everybody wants one. I don't know why, but you just want one because it looks cool, and they are showing that that is actually what works when it comes to that sort of place.
We did some work at Disney about this, and in fact, product placement works really well when there's strong engagement by consumers with the products. So with Star Wars, no one's unhappy about a Star Wars toy because they're going to love Star Wars, they're going to watch the movie, blah, blah, blah.
Unless it's Jar Jar Binks.
Well, okay, unless it's Jar Jar Binks. We'll forget Jar Jar Binks. But if the movie's not so good or the content's not so engaging, parents are really unhappy about Pester Power, really unhappy about having a toy rammed down their throat and being forced to buy it because the kid has asked for it because it's seen the advert or product placement in the programme. But if they love the show, they're quite happy to pay for it.
Don't ram a toy down your throat, kids. It's dangerous.
It's very dangerous, yeah.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Good morning, friends of the Media Podcast. I'm taking a punt here, but it feels like a morning show this week. We'll get back to the media news in just a minute, but before we do, you've been hearing me blather on about supporting this show since September when we were at the Radio Festival, and since then, every single episode of this has been funded by you. My interview with David Schneider and David Levin, funded by you. Radar Analysis with Matt Deegan, funded by you. Our carefully chosen pundits from across print and broadcast and online, their unguarded commentary, well, it would be left unrecorded, undistributed, unheard, were it not for you. And for that, we thank you, our donors, and we encourage you to join them if you haven't bothered yet. If you value what we're doing here at the Media Podcast, if you think there should be an independent voice in this industry of vested interests, then please go to our secure website, themediapodcast.com. Choose a level of support, either as a one-off or as a regular payment, and you can even do it from your mobile. Pause the pod, give generously, and hopefully we'll see you next year. Okay, back to the show. Time to tackle the other stories of the week. First up, ITV. Their chief exec, Adam Crozier, was in front of the Commons Culture, Media and Sport Select Committee on Tuesday, and he took the opportunity to discuss his broadcaster's commitments to regional broadcasting. I'm joking, of course not. He discussed the BBC. Faraz, what did he say about Auntie?
You put me on the spot. What did he say about Auntie? He said something about merging channels, right? About... BBC 4 and BBC 2 and 5 Live and Radio 4 or
yes,
something like that?
He said, you know, why did they axe BBC 3? There are all sorts of savings they could make, and then outlined 3 or 4 completely mental ideas, which those were two. Paul, what did you make of his suggestions?
Well, this was Adam Crozier positioning himself, wasn't it? I mean, it was pretty transparent what he was doing. I mean, in the BBC's favour...
Be clear, what was he doing?
ITV have got their own challenges, and the more that Crozier can put the BBC back into a distinctive box, the better ITV is going to do. So, of course, he's going to push for the BBC to be retreat its tanks off a number of lawns if he possibly can get them to reverse.
Strictly Come Dancing was one of the things.
Yeah, which is clearly
can you imagine?
Crazy. But, I mean, the question here is, do you want a BBC that's popular with a range of programmes, or do you want a BBC correcting market failure? And clearly Adam Crozier would like the latter. He's not going to get it, but I don't blame him for trying. His ideas were rather poor. I mean, the BBC Three thing, you have to say to some extent he has a point, in the sense that if the BBC were to say, hey, we're more efficient now, no one would ever believe them. And the BBC have become more efficient. Could they become more efficient still? Yes, they could. But putting BBC Three online is not a crazy idea. It does save a bit of money, not a lot, but the real budget is obviously in the commissioning. You know, it's a way of flagging up, we have got problems. And I think the BBC is genuinely feeling tight at the moment in terms of its finances. It genuinely is feeling that. In terms of the ideas, I'll talk about the radio one, because that's the most crazy.
Absolutely insane.
And I spent a lot of time on the strategy for this. In fact, it was me who devised the strategy for Radio 4 and Radio 5.
Okay, well, keep it brief, Paul.
I won't show you the PowerPoint. They are completely different services, serving completely different audiences, doing completely different things. There is no way the BBC could have a live sports service offering, for example, every Premier League game if it was on Radio 4. Radio 4's schedule would not work anymore. That's one reason, apart from many others. So that was a bonkers idea. It also won't save very much. I mean, radio's very cheap. You know, radio's really cheap. It's like 10 minutes of EastEnders. You know, what's the point?
I also would like to see what would happen if they suddenly put 606 on Radio 4 Extra. How would the listeners respond?
Well, that's not such a crazy idea, actually, but, you know.
The reason that we're talking about this, though, is because I think it's quite clear that Adam Crozier doesn't listen to 5 Live. And so when this is the problem, when you have people that have judgments about what these brands are and what they do. I imagine the reason that Adam Crozier has suggested this is because he feels like 5 Live is a talk channel, and it's, you know, a lot of its stuff is around sport, and Radio 4 doesn't do sport, nor should it do sport. But going back to the BBC 3 argument, and I'll get on my soapbox about this again, where he is correct is when it comes to BBC 3, what's happened there, and it's kind of an argument that's continuing to be successfully swept under the carpet by the bigwigs at BBC, they have cut £30 million from services for younger people to invest it into drama. And it's my belief that we don't need another £30 million worth of public money invested into drama when you have so much choice with drama across the board, including things like Amazon with Highcastle and what Netflix are doing and, you know, commissioning their first UK drama. ITV are a big drama supplier as well. I don't necessarily believe that you need to have the BBC investing another £30 million into that space. But what you do need is, and I think everybody across the board agrees on this, is that there is a lack of services for teenagers, particularly British teenagers in the UK. And there is some market correction that needs to be done there. In addition to market correction, there is also a gap in the market that is probably going to be filled by ITV2 and E4. That is only a thing that, you know, BBC are going to lose out on as a result.
Talking of telly for younger people, Disney have just doubled their stake in Vice Media. Just as the media group embarks on an expansion into broadcast TV. What do you think about those plans for us? It seems to be that people are investing in Vice at the time they're moving away from what has made them successful.
So the things about the most interesting thing about Vice for me, again, to kind of talk about the BBC Three thing, is that they've actually decided that they do want to be on linear television at a time when we've been hearing an argument for a very long time from the BBC saying young people don't watch linear television anymore. So there's obviously something bizarre going on there in the first instance. But I do wonder about this, how Vice are going to continue their credibility to be the anarchist voice for young people when they've got investment from Murdoch and now investment from Disney. That to me suggests that there's going to be a significant problem in them convincing young people that they are an authentic rebel voice that they originally were when they first started.
But it almost brings us back to the Channel 4 argument in a way, doesn't it, Paul? Because you'd end up possibly with a massive American corporation like Disney buying Channel 4. It would be one of those big companies who would swoop in and buy it, and you do lose distinctiveness when that happens, even if the audience aren't immediately aware of it.
Well, I think Disney buying Channel 4 is almost so unlikely, is almost not worth discussing, well, no,
but
to be honest.
Discovery buying Channel 4 would not be at all ridiculous, would it?
Discovery,
that's my point. It could be a big company like that. Well, does that dilute the vision of what you're buying?
I don't think it makes sense to say because it's a big company or they'll all do the same things. That's not a sensible route to go. Discovery could possibly be a buyer. But I think the salient point is that Disney are professional tire kickers. And so this may be a bit of tire kicking. They may then dispose again. They haven't got any executive control at this point. So it's purely an investment for them. So the issue is going to be whether consumers are aware of the Disney shareholding and whether that alters their perception of the brand. And secondly, whether the management are allowed to continue doing what they do well and do that despite the shareholding. If Disney were to take a controlling interest or were to have executives there, it would fundamentally change it because Disney do things the way Disney do it. And you know, I know that very, very well. I think this is because Disney want to understand what Vice are about. They think Vice have got some tools they haven't got. They want to learn about Vice. That's what this is about, I'm sure.
It's clear that Disney are looking to target young men with their acquisition of Marvel and their acquisition of Star Wars. They've done some interesting moves to kind of branch out from... I think they've been very successful with younger girls and you know, Frozen is a huge example of that and that's a thing that's just kind of taken off. And I think actually the Disney Channel, when you look at things like Hannah Montana and High School Musical and the hits they continue to produce in that space, it does feel like they skew more female. But Marvel has been a massive successful acquisition for them in reaching an audience that they never really spoke to previously. This could be another one of those, but I think there's more question marks about what does this mean for Vice rather than what does this mean for Disney. Disney will do this and it will work for them, great. If it doesn't work for them, who cares? You know, they still got ESPN and that will continue, and ABC and all of these other massive brands. But it'll be interesting to know how Vice are going to continue to be this rebel brand that they claim to be when you're taking investment like this.
If they do continue to be a rebel brand, it'd be interesting to see what they do to Mickey's Christmas Parade. I don't know if there'll be a Vice float. If the Radio Academy had a Disney parade, they would, of course, base it around their annual Hall of Fame. Paul, who were joining the ranks this year?
So we've got Nihal, Victoria Derbyshire and Frank Skinner. So I guess that probably ticks all the buttons very nicely for them.
Nihal, Victoria Derbyshire, Frank Skinner. Frank Skinner's not been doing radio very long, has he? I know he is actually, like, ironically, he's the most famous in the Hall of Fame, but he's not really a radio guy, is he?
You have to, yes.
He's a stand-up comic who's on the radio because he couldn't get a television
show. Why are the particular names chosen? It's linked to a luncheon and they have to sell tickets. And Frank will sell tickets.
I would rather see Frank Skinner.
It's a terribly cynical view, but you know, that is the reality.
I would rather see his acceptance.
Coming from someone who is the former chief executive of the Radio Academy.
Uh-huh. But to be fair to Frank, he's
very good.
A very good breakfast show that when you look at, you know, Chris Moyles and all of those guys in you know, attracting that space, he was the calling card for Absolute Radio for a little while, wasn't he?
So, his Saturday morning show, yeah, absolutely, yeah. And he's done a good job. I mean, he's really adapted to the medium very well. He's very funny, you know, and he loves it. He genuinely loves it. He's very passionate about it.
And Nihal, I understand you have a personal connection to for us.
Nihal, so I used to work with Nihal when I worked at the Asian Programs Unit back in the day. So he DJed my wedding last year. So that's my claim to fame.
Amazing. A claim to the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I know. But what exactly is... What does it mean? What does the Hall of Fame mean then?
Names
means he charges more to DJ a wedding. We can't end this week's show without mentioning Alan Yentob, of course, who has resigned as the BBC's creative director over the Kids Company controversy. Let's not go over all that again, but Faraz, will you miss him?
Well, obviously, Alan Yentob's left, and the whole of the BBC is now in crisis. No one really knows what it stands for and what it does anymore, which is obviously not true. I think that he's still going to do Imagine.
Still going to do Imagine. Still going to run BBC Films, but not report directly to Tony Hall. How's that going to work?
I think everybody kind of really did scratch their head when it comes to Alan Yentob being a creative director of the BBC and what it actually meant and where his influence was. And, you know, did he decide on what the graphics looked like on Strictly Come Dancing? I'm not entirely sure, you know, what his job description was and how it worked.
Paul's,
and
Paul's not laughing. Paul, are you a Yentob apologist? Someone should defend him.
No, I remember Alan Yentob, you know, meeting Alan Yentob at TV Centre, and I mean, he never stayed for the whole meeting. He'd, you know, disappear, he'd come and go, you know, he wouldn't have his minutes. It was always a shambles. I mean, he'd, you know, make a couple of good comments, and then, you know, it was always, I'd never understood what he did, and that was going back to, you know, the 90s. I'm just disappointed that Adam Crozier didn't pick up on Alan Yentob and use that. That would be a far more powerful
argument. For our purposes, that would be
absolutely far more powerful argument to say that was a bit of a wipe. Look, it's saving money, isn't it?
Good with talent. Saving. Good with talent. That's what they say about Yentob. Before we go, there's just time for our media quiz. This week, it is entitled Mistakes Were Made. In the cut and the thrust of journalism, sometimes a story slips out that needs to be corrected. But why? Why have these publications apologised this week? It's a quickfire quiz, as ever, so you buzz in with your name. Faraz, you say?
Oh, Faraz.
Yeah, just Faraz.
Without the O bit.
Yeah, and Paul, you say?
Paul.
Very good, let's go. The winner gets Sports Personality of the Year. The loser is Tyson Fury. Here's question number one. Why did ITV News apologise this week? Buzz when you know the answer. Faraz.
I love this story.
It's amazing.
It is amazing. So ITV did a little feature on Lenny Henry and his amazing work in diversity in television.
Sir Lenny Henry,
my apologies.
As the point was being made, getting his knighthood.
And they decided to show all of the good work he did by playing a clip of him dancing with the maracas. Unfortunately, it wasn't him. It was actually Ainsley Harriott from Ready, Steady, Cook. Innocent mistake, I'm sure.
Yeah. I mean, they haven't said, have they? They've apologised. They haven't said how the mistake happened. In fairness, and it still ultimately comes down to the fact that someone thought two black men looked the same, but in fairness, it was a clip of Ainsley Harriott at the Comedy Store. It wasn't Ainsley Harriott cooking. So it was...
an amazing clip.
So it is an amazing clip. Someone obviously filed it incorrectly in the archive, but then no one seemed to notice until after it was far too late. And Paul, my favourite moment of this was the screen grab that someone on Twitter did of when ITV Plus One played out the news at 10. And they flashed up that little warning saying we're unable to bring this to your region at the moment. They're obviously highly embarrassed very quickly.
Well, they should be. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Here's question number two. Why has the Sun said soz this week?
Paul. So this is a reporter who allegedly travelled from Turkey to Paris without actually showing his passport once.
Big headline story on The Sun Saturday, yeah.
Yeah, and apparently it was untrue. He showed his passport at least once, or at least twice apparently, in Croatia, getting in and out of Zagreb.
We could attack The Sun for, you know, not properly checking this story out. They were running a big front page story saying our journalist, our guy, travels across the route that many refugees have done and look, he doesn't have his passport checked twice. But Faraz, this was a freelance journalist. They presumably believed that he was putting his own reputation on the line by saying this had happened. I mean, in, as much as anything, the guy, Emil Gessen, this was sort of his fault, wasn't it, for claiming that he'd done this thing? Yes, he got his big scoop, but then now he looks stupid, doesn't he? Looks like he tried to con the paper.
No one cares about who the reporter is when you're a reader of The Sun, do you? You just care about the headline, and the fact that you put something like that on the front page of the paper without doing your appropriate checks and balances about if the story's true is scandalous. I mean, it's like, if the BBC or it did something like that, Sky would have them for breakfast. It's just completely inappropriate, and I don't understand, you know, why the Red Top press continue to be able to, not just the Red Top press, but why the press in general continues to be able to get away with this. It's you know, they're putting...
It's called lack of regulation, or lack of really regulation with teeth.
It's deeply. I mean, as somebody from a Muslim background, and you know, it's deeply offensive when you have these things like, you know, one in five Muslims agree with ISIS, and now, you know, you can be a Syrian refugee and get across the borders without any problems whatsoever. It's not helpful in any way, shape, or form. It doesn't do anything to the debate, and it particularly causes even more problems when it's just simply untrue.
Which is fine, and I accept your point. But what about my point? The journalist who actually said that he'd done this and obviously hadn't. That was a long-term error for him, wasn't it? I mean, you know, The Sun aren't going to employ him again.
But The Sun aren't going to employ him again. They're still going to sell papers next week. If I'm honest, it doesn't really matter about the journalist. When we've had the phone hacking scandal and people have continued to do wrongdoing, it's the paper, it's The Sun that continue to make money out of these stories. They're the ones that have the influence and they're the ones that profit at the end of the day.
So did The Sun know, or did The Sun fail to check?
Did The Sun care?
Well, we don't know. I mean, that's the question I'm asking. I mean, this guy presumably claimed he'd actually done this to get the story and to get the piece. The question is, why did The Sun not check?
Although it still didn't match Tom Latcham's rifling through Adele's attic scoop, as far as I'm concerned.
No.
Did you see it? Made it into The Sun on Sunday.
Yeah.
After it was revealed exclusively on the Media Podcast. Yeah, we had the scoop. Yeah, that she had a guitar when she was a child. Right, well, here is the tiebreaker. Question number three. Who is BuzzFeed refusing to say sorry to after calling them, quote, a mendacious racist?
Faraz, I guess it has to be Donald Trump.
It is! Faraz, congratulations.
Why would they need to apologise for that?
BuzzFeed's editor-in-chief had sent round a memo to all the staff this week saying that calling Trump a mendacious racist on their social media wasn't opinion, but a matter of fact.
Look, I don't think Donald Trump cares, and I don't think any, you know, I don't think it matters to anybody. I think that his outlandish comments continue to gain press, and they continue to create debate, and that's why we're having massive petitions. And, you know, Katie Hopkins today said something outrageous, like 25% of the UK population agrees with Donald Trump, and it's just, it continues to be nonsense. But the, you know, Trump's campaign is, I don't want to call it clever, because that kind of makes it more than it actually is, but it's clear that what he's doing is every time his polls slip, he puts out something outrageous to get him on Fox and Friends again.
Well, here at the Media Podcast, we are always fair and balanced, and the audience can transparently hear for us that you are today's winner. Congratulations.
Oh, yeah, it's a quiz. Amazing.
You trumped it. My thanks to Faraz Osman and to Paul Robinson. Remember, you can subscribe to this programme on your phone, and then it'll download as soon as it's ready via the magic of podcasting. Just visit themediapodcast.com and find out how. Today's episode is dedicated to these fine, upstanding citizens: Adam Bowie, John Collins, Stephen Taylor and Simon Woods. In years to come, songs shall be written about them because they are like gods. Similarly, these wonderful people should be lauded for setting up recurring payments, which allows us to plan shows not just in a fortnight, but forever. Massive thanks to HOD, Mr. F.A. Casella, Lou A. Ismail, Alison Ross and Joanna Card, and to Edmund Baker, who asks us to check out the Neon Saints Brass Band, a funky hip-hop brass onslaught from Brighton, UK. Debut album out now. Check out Neon Saints Brass Band wherever you get your tunes. To join these swelling ranks and keep us on the air, please go to themediapodcast.com/dedicate. Give us some money. Keep us on air. It takes 1 minute. Do it now. Thanks very much. I've been Ollie Mann. The producer was Matt Hill. And the Media Podcast is a PPM production. Till next time, bye-bye.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.